Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to a megasode of Cinematic Universe, the podcast that's all about comic book movies, which you can find at cinematicuniverse.com. I'm your host, Joe Cunningham, and I'll be bringing you a truncated version of the show to bridge the gap between our Spider-Man Homecoming and the Amazing Spider-Man 2 episodes. I'll be giving you my reactions to the comics that Seven James recommended over the course of the last two podcasts, so lots of Dread and Spider-Man goodness in there. But before any of that, let's take a look at some of the comic book movie news that has broken over the past, probably month now. Lots to get to. So before we start, I will point out none of this is going to be anything that has come out of Comic-Con. I'm kind of recording this as Comic-Con is just getting going. So there's going to be lots of stuff to discuss next week. James and I are going to be convening to record a Comic-Con special bonus episode next week. And I think there's going to be lots of stuff to talk about there. But this is all of the stuff that has broken prior to that. And the majority or the biggest news came out of another kind of convention last weekend, the Disney D23 Con. And so we should probably talk about the Infinity War teaser that played at that convention. Now, by the time you're hearing this, maybe Marvel have released this as part of the Comic-Con stuff. But we got a description out of D23. And so I think I'll just run through basically what we've been told happens in that teaser, because it sounds pretty fun. So it starts off with Thor meeting the Guardians of the Galaxy in space. He smashes into their windscreen like a bug in what sounds like a callback to the first Thor movie in the hospital. They then kind of see some bad stuff going on in space. Loki holds up the Tesseract to present it to someone, presumably Thanos. And then there's a shot on Earth with Iron Man standing with the Guardians of the Galaxy, and they talk about how Thanos is coming to them. So it sounds like the battle is taking place on Earth in this movie rather than in any cosmic realm. Spider-Man is around. He's wearing the fancy gold suit from the end of Spider-Man Homecoming. Bucky and Black Panther are together leading armies into battle. Captain America turns up looking disheveled, longer hair and a beard, potentially in his guise as Nomad, but it sounds like he is at this point not actually Captain America, so maybe another character will have taken up that mantle in the time being. There's a shot of Vision being imprisoned. There is a shot of Thanos grabbing Thor's skull and beginning to crush it. There is Black Widow, who is now blonde. And Thanos, apparently at the end of the teaser, pulls down a moon using the Infinity Gauntlet, which is at this stage only partially assembled. So it sounds like that at least at the start of this film, Thanos doesn't have all of the Infinity Gems, and maybe he doesn't assemble them all until part two. So that all sounds fun. I think it'll be a lot more fun once we get to watch it. But almost inevitably, the idea of this movie, when it's just conceptually out there, I'm not massively excited about, because it just sounds like it's too big and unwieldy. And then you hear about the footage and it starts to crystallize the real thing. And I go, oh no, yeah. I'm excited about that. I'm excited about Iron Man fighting alongside the Guardians of the Galaxy and all of those characters meeting up in a movie. And all I need is one shot of Daredevil and I'll be happy. I don't think it will happen, but I would be very happy. The other thing that was confirmed at D23 is that Thanos will have some minions. His minions are the Black Order. So they'll be the characters of Corvus Glaive, Proxima Midnight, Ebony Maw, and Cull Obsidian, who apparently is a character who's been renamed from Black Dwarf in the comics. So they're his henchmen, potentially his adopted children. And set leaks from the movie had kind of hinted that these characters were in it already. So now it's been confirmed. We think Terry Notary is playing one of those characters. He is an actor who did a lot of mocap on stuff like the Planet of the Apes, the recent Planet of the Apes trilogy. So yeah, Thanos is going to have some minions, and that will probably help in terms of having a more globe-spanning battle against Thanos. Say if one of them turns up in Wakanda, for instance, and there's other ones elsewhere, you can have like multi-pronged adventures with the Avengers in the early parts of Infinity War. But it looks like they are all going to be motion captured, so it'll be interesting to find out if there are any other actors that we know playing the other parts. So that's all of the Infinity War stuff, and yeah, fingers crossed. At this point, Marvel haven't done their panel at Comic-Con, but fingers crossed that we will be able to watch that footage sooner rather than later. There's a lot more MCU stuff, though. Ant-Man and the Wasp has cast Randall Park as S.H.I.E.L.D. agent Jimmy Woo. I don't know much about Jimmy Woo. I don't know whether S.H.I.E.L.D. technically still exists in the MCU movies, but they're going to have a S.H.I.E.L.D. agent in them. And basically, it's Randall Park, and Randall Park is great, and I'm thrilled that he is going to be part of that movie. Ant-Man and the Wasp has also cast Walton Goggins in an unnamed part, but surely he's got to be the villain. And honestly, if Marvel can't make a great villain with Walton Goggins, something has gone badly wrong. So Ant-Man and the Wasp, I am massively psyched for, and with every casting addition, I get more excited for. I'm really excited to see what Peyton Reed particularly does when he's planning this film from start to finish, rather than coming in at the last minute and kind of saving the day. I was talking to James off mic recently, but the more I read or hear about what Peyton Reed wanted to do with his Fantastic Four film back in the day, that just sounded fascinating, and I'm psyched to see what he can come up with, and he's certainly nailing the casting part of things. Captain Marvel is rumoured to be featuring Nick Fury. There's some kind of reports out there that he could be a co-lead. It could be nothing more than a cameo, but I guess with Captain Marvel being a film that has some kind of military basis in it around Carol Danvers, Nick Fury would make sense as a character who would show up around that. And it's been, considering how like ubiquitous Nick Fury was in the MCU for such a long time, I don't think he's turned up since Age of Ultron. And so it would be nice for him to pop up again at some point, because it's Samuel L. Jackson and he owns that character. So that's great. On to Spider-Man Homecoming. Apparently, the Spider-Man Homecoming Blu-ray will feature a lot more of those Captain America PSAs that we saw in the film, which is great news. Apparently, John Watts, if he exists, had Chris Evans just like standing in front of a camera for like a few hours, the amount of time that he had him, and just said, "Now read this one, now read that one, now read that one." So there's a lot more of those to look forward to on the Blu-ray. Hopefully a one-shot as well. Tom Holland talked about maybe the one-shots coming back in the future, and I would love for those short films to return to the Marvel Blu-rays, because they were a lovely little addition, and some of them are actually good within their own rights. All Hail the King and Agent Carter, particularly. More Blu-ray stuff for Marvel. There is going to be an extended music video for that David Hasselhoff song on the Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 Blu-ray, and all of the main cast are going to be in there in kind of 1980s glitter garb, so you can look forward to that as well. Last bit of Marvel news, this is Marvel TV news. Luke Cage Season 2 has cast Mustafa Shakir as the character of John McIver. He apparently is Bushmaster in the comics, and Gabriel Dennis is playing a character called Tilda Johnson, who is Nightshade. Also, Lucy Liu is going to be directing the pilot for that, and something that did come out of Comic-Con is that Simone Missick, who was in Luke Cage Season 1, will be joining the cast of Iron Fist Season 2, but I imagine we'll be chatting quite a bit about The Defenders and Punisher and a lot of other Marvel TV stuff on our Comic-Con episode. So we'll move over to DC now. DC have scheduled two untitled films for 2020, which brings the total to four films in that year. That could be the Batman movie. I mean, at this point, it could be anything. I think probably not the Batman movie. I think that'll be 2019 because that's a Bat anniversary, and I think that maybe we might, that DC and Warner might try and turn that into the year of the Bat. But, you know, it wouldn't be beyond the realm of possibility for DC to not get their shit together and fail to deliver that in the year that it is appropriate. So one of those films could be a Batman movie. We should address the Batman stuff before, because it did kind of break before Comic-Con. So Matt Reeves, it was announced last week, was rewriting Ben Affleck's Batman script. So that film has obviously gone from Ben Affleck star, director, producer, writer, to him losing the director, like stepping aside from directing, to then his script being completely rewritten by Matt Reeves, who is now planning out a trilogy. And then came the news a day before Comic-Con, I think, that Warner Brothers were considering potentially moving away from Ben Affleck as Batman, that if they were planning a trilogy, Ben Affleck's already in his late 40s, and that by the time they get through a full trilogy, you're talking about Ben Affleck being in his mid-50s, and that he would be too old for it, basically. To which I say, why did you cast a old Batman in the first place? So the rumours out there are that this Justice League movie could be the last to feature Ben Affleck as Batman. There are some sites kind of reporting it as that is what's going to happen. So hopefully there'll be a little bit of clarity coming to that, but we could have seen the last, or we could be about to see the last of Ben Affleck as Batman, which raises a bunch of questions about what DC are going to do, whether they just recast the part, whether they try and do a Batman Beyond thing with Matt Reeves's trilogy, whether they maybe try and do some fudging in the main timeline of the DC movies to kind of create an alternate universe. Maybe we move over to Earth 2 and take nothing but Wonder Woman. You know, the possibilities are endless, but that's certainly very interesting indeed. The Shazam movie is rumoured to start production next year. It won't star The Rock. David F. Sandberg is directing, and yeah, that's an interesting one to move forward, because for a long time it looked like Black Adam with The Rock would be happening before Shazam, and now it sounds like it's actually going to be the way around that makes a little bit more sense. And I guess if they can make Shazam work and then they can make Black Adam work, then you've got a cool, you can kind of have them meeting up in a final movie down the line. But again, with DC, it seems like they throw a lot of stuff out there and see whether it works, see whether it doesn't. Speaking of something that didn't work, Suicide Squad. Suicide Squad, John Colet-Serra has become the front runner to direct the sequel. He's a director that I actually really like, and I think has shown a lot of talent. I haven't actually seen The Shallows, which he directed last year, which I know got a lot of plaudits. But if you look through his filmography, he directed House of Wax, which is interesting. He directed Orphan, which I think is great. Nonstop is a very underrated thriller on a plane with Liam Neeson, which knows exactly how silly it is. And so yeah, I like the guy. There's duds in there. There's Unknown. I haven't seen Run All Night either, but he's an interesting director, and I think it's certainly more promising for Suicide Squad 2 with him attached rather than Mel Gibson, who I just think would have been a terrible fit for the Suicide Squad movies. So yeah, I'm not sure Suicide Squad 2 deserves John Colet-Serra, but it looks like that film is moving forward and that he is the name most likely to be directing. We'll move on from DC now over to Fox. Fox has also announced some more dates. They have announced some dates for six untitled Marvel films between 2019 and 2021. One of those appears to be Noah Hawley's Doctor Doom movie, which was news that broke at Comic-Con and we'll be addressing next week. And you'd imagine stuff like X-Force, another X-Men sequel, stuff like that would be part of those plans as well. And hey, who knows, maybe even Gambit. The New Mutants movie has replaced Rosario Dawson. She left the cast. I didn't even spot this news happen. This happened like weeks ago at this point, and I missed it until I was going over the news for the podcast. She's been replaced by Alice Braga, who is another fantastic actress who I feel has never really got her break in Hollywood, never really like got the projects that she deserved. So I'm made up for her that she's in this movie, and still looking forward to New Mutants quite a bit as well. Evan Peters will in fact be appearing in X-Men Dark Phoenix. He was kind of the one name missing from that original casting announcement, but apparently he will be in it. So that's good news for all of you Quicksilver fans. And then Deadpool 2 announced that Julian Dennison was joining the cast. Now, if you don't know who Julian Dennison is, he is the child star of Taika Waititi's Hunt for the Wilder People. He played Ricky Baker in just one of the most utterly charming performances you're likely to see. If you haven't seen Hunt for the Wilder People, go watch it. If you're in the UK, it's on Netflix, or at least it was. I watched it on Netflix, and it's so good, and it's, you know, it's good superhero revision, because you'll be getting to see the director of Thor Ragnarok's last movie, and you'll be able to see one of the stars of Deadpool 2. So that's definitely something to look forward to there. And just a couple of final things now, away from the Marvel, DC, Fox universes. The Incredibles 2, that was some footage from that was shown at D23, and apparently it's going to start 1 minute after the first film. So like right after they meet the Underminer at the end of that movie, you'll get a big action sequence with the Underminer to start, and then it will involve the family discovering baby Jack-Jack has superpowers, and I think the film might revolve around that to some extent, because Jack-Jack is, if memory serves, very overpowered compared to the rest of the family. And yeah, it's Brad Bird directing another Incredibles film, so that sounds great to me. I don't think Pixar's sequels have been working out fantastically over the last few years. In fact, I think that like the Cars, Monsters, Inc. and Finding Nemo sequels have all been flat out bad. So, I kind of trust Brad Bird more than any other director that they've got working at Pixar, and we'll have to cover The Incredibles at some point on the podcast so we can trot out the now standard is the best Fantastic Four movie line. And then finally, Spencer and Locke, which is a comic about a hardboiled detective and his imaginary partner, has been optioned for a movie. I haven't read that comic, don't know anything about it, but it sounds like an interesting premise. And we'll see whether that actually comes about, because it seems like a lot of these indie comics are optioned and some of them make their way to the screen. So we'll see what happens with Spencer and Locke. But that's it for this week's comic book movie and TV news, and we'll move on now to the comic book recommendations. Okay, and I think we'll start off with the 2000 AD recommendations from our Dread episode. So that was the episode with Seb and Caroline, so it was two recommendations from Seb. And kind of three, but kind of two. So these are all from Progs, 2000 AD Progs. The story arcs are The Day the Law Died, that was from John Howard and primarily Mike McMahon on art, although there were some other artists during that kind of longer arc. And then the two stories, Judge Death and Judge Death Lives, which were written by John Howard for the first arc, T.B. Grover for the second, and it was all drawn by Brian Bolland. Or Bolland, I can't remember how to pronounce that. But what I do know is that his art is very, very good. So I'll kind of talk about these generally and then get into the specifics of each story. But I think the thing that I came away from this, and I'm going to sound like a comics philistine, I definitely struggle with black and white comics more than colour comics. And I know if someone said that about movies to me, like, oh, I can't watch black and white movies. I'd be like, well, what do you mean? That doesn't make any sense. And I know that I must sound like a philistine. I just find them a little bit more difficult to read, and that, like, especially in kind of particularly busy panels, I'm going, whoa, okay, take a step back, what's actually going on here, where's the text, where's the picture. So yeah, that's on me, that's bad. I struggle with them a little bit more, but having said that, I found the contrast between the Brian Bolland drawn stuff in 2000 AD and all of the other stuff like striking. Bolland stuff was so much easier to read, so much more rewarding to read. The images are absolutely gorgeous, and kind of like the way that he introduces Judge Death, for example, or does other stuff with the... He's just like, there are panels that you go, okay, yeah, you could take that out and make a print of that and hang it on your wall. That's excellent. That looks great. And the Mike McMahon, it just felt a little bit less... It tended to feel more busy. It tended to feel... The panels were just a little bit of a blur when you look at them, and then you have to dive in. Whereas with Bolland, it's like, oh, that's the image. Okay, and now I'll read and figure out what's going on. So like I say, the black and white stuff is on me, but I think that when the art is great, it kind of transcends that, and it stopped being an issue for me. But The Day the Lord Died, which does have some Bolland in it, but not very much, is the longer story arc that Seb recommended to me, which involves the character of Judge Cal, who, the names and stuff are very on the nose. Judge Cal is basically Judge Caligula, and I think that it's like a... I read on the Wikipedia page it was like a parody of the John Hurt character from I, Claudius, and which was obviously airing at the time, and that's on the nose. Like, Judge Cal ends up coming to power when he murders the former head judge, who was called Judge Goodman, who I guess was a good man, and Judge Cal is a bad man. I don't know whether that is his surname canonically, but I wouldn't put it past the comic. And there's lots of stuff like that. There is lots of like very on the nose, like there's sometimes like characters even will be like almost double taking into the camera, looking kind of breaking the fourth wall almost. And like Cal drops a couple of gags at some point. I can see why Seb recommended this, by saying that it felt in some way that were parallels to the real world and to Trump. Certainly the way that Cal is drawn, sometimes it does just look like Trump, this kind of like long, like bouffanted haired, jowly faced moron. I'm getting political. just like that's it, visually the Trump thing is hard to get past at points during this arc. There's not quite the real world nuance of however much nuance you can attribute to Trump, but there is certainly with Cal, it's just the case of like this guy is just nuts. Like, it's not even that he's evil; he's just off his rocker. And so it's just this kind of despotic guy who decides, to begin with, that he's just going to start making up laws and that they're going to be so like nondescript that people are going to fear stepping out of line at any point. And kind of all of these laws are punishable by death. And then at one point he decides that he's just going to line everyone up in the city and kill them until his deputy, Judge Fish, who is literally a goldfish, dies, and he decides that that's a bad omen and not to do that anymore. Until later in the arc, when he decides, no, I'm just going to gas the entire city and kill everyone. And Dredd kind of has to lead some kind of resistance. There are a number of kind of like resistance attempts throughout this long arc, and it's only the one at the end that is successful. And it's kind of this low life criminal who, like a simpleton, who ends up physically taking Cal down. But there's other parallels to the real world. Cal wants to build a wall around Mega City 1, except that's to keep the citizens in, rather than they try and flee to the cursed lands, which doesn't sound like a great idea, but I think the idea is that's how bad that things are in the city. So Cal kind of like gets slave labor to build this wall around the city. It's very on the nose. I didn't enjoy this story particularly. I think that I can see why the 2000 AD comics in general appeal. It's almost like there is a high concept and there's a plot at the start of every story idea. And I felt like there was almost like the same level of plot set up at the start of the 2 or 3 issue arc, that if the 2 or 3 issue Judge Death arcs than there were in the Judge Cal one. It's like crazy guy running the city and eventually Dredd will stop him. And Judge Death, dead judge ghost kind of character attacking the city, eventually Dredd will stop him. And it's just a case of like figuring out like how Dredd will overcome them And in between, there's going to be some cool art and there's going to be some funny little lines. It's kind of knowing. I kind of understand what Seb was saying about like downplaying the satire of 2000 AD, because this doesn't always feel like satire, but it feels like there's a lot of dark humor in there rather than there might be a little bit of commentary, but it doesn't really feel like it's satirizing anything more than just being a kind of like a comic with dark content that also has humor in there as well. I'm sure there is other parts of 2000 AD that is more nakedly satirical, but I didn't feel like I got a lot of that in these comics. I did enjoy the Judge Death and the Judge Death Lives comics that or story arcs more though. So Judge Death introduces Judge Death and also Judge Anderson from the Psy Division. So the character who ended up appearing in the Dread movie. And so it's just kind of this character just turns up from an alternate dimension. He's Judge Death. And in his dimension, they decided that all living people are the only people who commit crimes. Dead people don't. So everyone needs to die and then they'll stop committing crimes. So Judge Death kills everyone and then comes to Dread's dimension and decides that he's going to do the same there. And just anyone who's living can be killed. And so that's what he does. He kind of goes around the city. He kills people. Dread tracks him down. Judge Death eventually takes over Judge Anderson's mind because of her psychic link. He's able to kind of possess her body. But then they freeze her in some kind of like...
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. No matter what you do or what industry you're in, how you communicate is key. Everything you type is equally important to collaboration, and Grammarly can help. Think of it as your AI writing partner, empowering you to communicate effectively and efficiently so you can make a bigger impact in the workplace. 96% of Grammarly users say it helps them craft more impactful writing. And as the gold standard of responsible AI, Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. By understanding your writing in context, Grammarly provides relevant, personalized suggestions. And with tone suggestions, you can navigate even the most difficult work conversations. You can also save time from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds with one click. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
Plastic thing. It's almost like the Han Solo carbonite thing almost. And she kind of gets trapped in there with Death and she's sacrificed herself. But then in the sequel story, Judge Death Lives, someone lets Anderson out or lets Judge Death out, who then has three other judges, dark judges alongside him. One's Fire. I can't remember what they all are, but they're all kind of generally bad dudes and they've got the same MO as Judge Death. It's basically there's three more of them and they look cool. Like look at the cool designs, and I'm like, yeah, they do look cool. So they go around killing some people. Eventually this time the judges, the good judges, manage to get some kind of an upper hand, and so the dark judges retreat to their own dimension, and Anderson and Dread then dimension hop over there to take on the judges, because the dark judges, because they know they'll return. Anderson ends up taking them down through kind of using the spirits of all of the souls of the people in that dimension who were killed by the dark judges to attack them. And yeah, so like it was kind of fun. Like it zips along all of the, because it's 8 pages and because it's not really the most overwhelming in terms of a read. You can kind of zip through this at a good old pace and feel like you've had a nice little jaunt through the world of Mega City One. I don't think it's for me. I don't think it's the kind of comics that I would be rushing out to pick up. I can't imagine myself ever really being a 2000 AD reader, but I'm definitely glad they exist, and certainly in terms of, like, even now, the talent that is nurtured by 2000 AD that go off and become big deals in the world of comics, it's clearly a vital institution, and I'm sure maybe if I'd grown up reading them that I might have had a bit more affection for them, but I just, 2000 AD never seemed like the thing for me. I was always as a kid picking up the Beano and then fell off comics until I grew up, if indeed I did. So so that was the 2000 AD comics, which I would say, you know, like if you're into this kind of thing, I think particularly the Judge Death and Judge Death Lives arcs are really cool, and I can't praise the Bolland art enough. But comics that are much more nakedly made for me are Spider-Man comics. So we'll move on to the Spider-Man recommendations now. And I'll go with James's recommendation first, which is The Amazing Spider-Man Civil War. So this was the arc that ran through The Amazing Spider-Man comic, I think between issues 532 and 538, during Mark Miller's Civil War big crossover event. And there's like two or three lead up issues to that arc where Peter gets the Iron Spider costume from Tony Stark and starts working with him a little bit more closely. And Tony Stark kind of sees that this big flashpoint in the superhero world is approaching and is kind of positioning himself to tackle it when it does. And I'd read all of that stuff before when I'd started reading Civil War, but dropped off it. And so what I did, I read the Civil War main series and kind of hopped between that and these Amazing Spider-Man tie-ins. And like there's the stuff in the main series that you feel like, it probably would be good if I was reading the Fantastic Four alongside this, or it would be good if I'd been able to pop into that issue of that thing or whatever. But for the most part, I think probably this seems like it would be the best series to be reading alongside Civil War, especially in the first 3 or 4 issues of that series. And so if you don't know the Civil War story, but I guess most of you will, it's that Iron Man and Captain America kind of come to blows. There is a terrible tragedy in which a lot of civilians die in a school in Stamford after there's an explosion that involved the New Warriors. And so the superhero community fractures because the American government wants them all to register, wants them to reveal their identities, or at least register their identities with the government. And then kind of be like state-sanctioned superheroes. And Captain America and a lot of people who stand alongside him say, no, that's not right. And Iron Man leads the pro-registration movement. And Peter Parker is kind of established as... I'd say kind of like the moral center of this debate. So he's allied to Iron Man because Iron Man has kind of buttoned him up in advance. And so he does this big public revelation where he doesn't have to reveal his identity to the world as he does kind of on camera, but he does it as kind of a show of faith and a stand with Tony Stark. And it's been very cleverly manipulated by Stark to get to that point. Like, he knows the importance of having Peter Parker particularly revealing his identity on television. And it's then interesting having that context in the Spider-Man comics of a Peter Parker who is kind of battling with, is he doing the right thing? Is he putting his family at danger? He has the support of MJ and Aunt May to do what he does, but he's still kind of agonizing about it. And the joy of this series, mostly I would say, is reading that character and seeing him kind of trying to figure out whether what he's doing is the right thing, and eventually kind of switching sides and realizing that what he stands for is more closely aligned to what Captain America stands for, and that is the side that he has to ultimately fight on. I would say there are definitely some drawbacks in this being like the crossover with Civil War. I think it's what puts me off big crossovers in the Marvel DC universes or whatever. You've got this big series in the middle, Civil War, and all of the other comics are tying in. Except date-wise and like whether the comics actually come out at the right time or whatever, the crossovers might not necessarily work. So you've got kind of like you're reading one comic and that ends in one place and then the other one overlaps with it and goes a little bit further, and then there's something referred to that you haven't read happen in the main series yet, or you haven't read happen in the tie-in series yet. And then I think it'll just be like writers, not like Mark Miller probably can't communicate with every single writer writing every single tie-in and saying, oh, what have you done for that bit there? Oh, just establish this. But there's one bit where Peter goes to visit the prison where the superheroes who refuse to register are being held by Iron Man and Reed Richards. And it's in the Negative Zone. And Spider-Man says, so where are you going to move them after this? And Iron Man says, well, no, this is it. This is like, there's nowhere we can hold superheroes. This is where they're going to be. Like, we're treating them well. But yeah, they're in a prison on the Negative Zone. And Peter's like, what, forever? And it's like, yeah, Peter, that's the deal. And then in the next issue, when you then go over to read Civil War, there's one point where Peter and Iron Man are having it out kind of a day or two later. And Peter says, like, you've got these people locked up in prison. And Iron Man goes, it's a temporary measure, Peter. And you're like, okay, well, that's not what you said in the last comic. Which is it? It just is just almost like, oh, Iron Man needs to be a little bit right in this one. So we'll do this. And maybe we didn't. Maybe J. Michael Straczynski, who wrote the Amazing Spider-Man series, didn't really talk to Mark Miller enough about the nuance there. And it kind of takes away from things a little bit. The reason James recommended the series, though, I think, was that it was the comic that had the most of kind of a Peter Parker, Tony Stark relationship. And certainly early on, and I think in those three lead-up issues. So if you want to get more of a sense of that relationship, I'd suggest starting in the kind of the road to Civil War issues with Peter Parker and Tony Stark, where he gets gifted the Iron Spider suit and all that kind of stuff. I think early on there are parallels that you can draw with Homecoming, the kind of the mentor mentee, the kind of the big international superhero and the more street level hero interacting. But this is Mark Miller writing Iron Man, and Mark Miller writing Iron Man is a lot more cynical and jaded than, like, I would almost say the Civil War Iron Man feels like more of a satirical take on that kind of character, more of a bastard than even the one who shows up in the Ultimates. Because the Ultimates Tony Stark is just a drunk, whereas this guy kind of, you definitely do see that he is doing what he's doing for a reason. But whereas, I mean, we joke on the podcast about Captain America and Iron Man in Captain America Civil War and who's in the right. But I think one of the things that that movie did really well is that you can come out of that movie and you understand both points of view, and you understand that they're both doing things that are right and both doing things that are wrong. But that ultimately you pick your side. You pick the one that you think was more right than the other one. The comic, I think, firmly comes down on the side that Iron Man is in the wrong, even though he's doing it for the right reasons. And that Iron Man, particularly with his relationship with Peter, a lot of the times it feels exploitative. And like the Iron Man is using Peter to an extent. I don't think the movie could do that with Homecoming, like, because Peter is so young. I think if there was a more exploitative relationship from Stark, it would completely sour you on that character. I know there is an article out on Vulture, the ironically titled Vulture, saying that Iron Man's the real villain of Spider-Man Homecoming. But I think the mentorship is sweet. I think Tony Stark wanting Peter Parker to be a better man in Homecoming is genuine, and I think it rings true. That's not the relationship that you see on play in Civil War. But certainly, you know, if you want to read one of the biggest stories in comics of the past 15, 20 years, you know, Civil War and this tie-in alongside it, it's a fascinating read. I think I actually preferred the straight-up Spider-Man stuff. If I didn't mention, that series is written by J. Michael Straczynski, drawn by Ron Garney. I really enjoyed it, and I like Peter Parker as a character. But he's not my favourite Spider-Man, and that's a tease because we're moving on to the final recommendation, which was Seb's recommendation from last week's podcast, which was Ultimate Comics Spider-Man Volume 1. Written by Brian Michael Bendis, drawn by Sarah Pacelli. It was Volume 1 and Volume 2, in fact. And although the majority is drawn by Sarah Pacelli, there is some art in there from David Marquez and Chris Samnee as well. I think maybe 3 or 4 fill-in issues over the course of the 12. I know a lot of people have been talking about Spider-Man Homecoming, and that's finally the first time that they've seen their Spider-Man up on screen. Or maybe that's not my Spider-Man, but it's the closest we've come to it. I think that from when I've been reading comics, the Spider-Man that I enjoy reading the most, I wouldn't say I identify the most with, but the one that I sympathise the most with is Miles Morales. I find just a constant joy reading that character, and it feels fresh and exciting and new and filled with possibilities for maybe like that classic take on Spider-Man, but in the modern day. And I know that that is Ultimate Comics Peter Parker as well, or Ultimate Spider-Man, the Peter Parker Ultimate Spider-Man, but it reading the first couple of arcs of that didn't stay with me the same way that reading the first couple of arcs of the Miles Morales stuff did. I've been reading the Miles Morales stuff since Secret Wars in the main universe. I obviously read the Spider-Men crossover from a previous recommendation, and I just really, really like this character. I think when Brian Michael Bendis is firing, he can be one of my favourite comics writers, and this is really, really great. And he's lucky that he has Sarah Pacelli next to him, who her art on for Miles Morales is fantastic. The Miles Morales costume is so cool. The way that they realise his powers is fantastic. But just the way that Sarah Pacelli draws Miles Morales as just a human kid, and the emotion that she's able to get across from that character so frequently throughout this comic is incredible. And lucky, you know, like the fill-in issues here are from David Marquez and Chris Samnee, who are really great as well. So when Pacelli's not there, it doesn't feel like you're really suffering. But when she turns back up, you're like, ah, right, okay, yeah, this is fantastic. So to actually talk more about the character and more about the story here, rather than just me saying why I love Miles Morales, to get into some specifics, this story is kind of Peter Parker has just died in the Ultimate Universe, and Miles Morales is shortly thereafter bitten by a spider. And it should seem really silly, but it kind of feels believable enough in this world that Norman Osborn had been developing. He knew that the spider that bit Peter Parker had turned him into Spider-Man, so he was trying to recreate the formula and was breeding lots of more genetically altered spiders. Miles Morales' uncle, Aaron Davis, is a supervillain called the Prowler. He steals something from Norman Osborn's lab, and the spider climbs up onto his suit as he's escaping. And then when Miles is visiting his flat, his apartment, the spider bites Miles, and Miles gets superpowers. They are Spider-Man-esque powers, so he has the spidey sense, he has the athleticism, he has all that kind of stuff. He can't produce webs, though. He has this little thing called, like, a venom blast, which, like, he can, like, touch someone and, like almost buzz and incapacitate them. He can turn invisible briefly, so he's got kind of, like, camouflage powers. So they are, like, spider-esque powers, but different spider powers to what Spider-Man had. And so it's kind of like him embracing this responsibility, but in a different way. Like, he kind of doesn't want to be Spider-Man to begin with. He's overwhelmed by the idea of it. The last Spider-Man had just died, and he'd never considered being a superhero, but he's got his best friend Genki there, who he tells immediately. And Genki kind of like encourages him, and Genki is like Ned Leeds in the Spider-Man Homecoming movie is Genki. It just is. It's that is that character exactly. And only I like him a lot more in the comics. But yeah, so he kind of encourages Miles, and Miles eventually embraces it, and the world kind of reacts badly to begin with, because they see a kid dressing up in a Spider-Man costume shortly after Peter Parker's been killed, and they think that it's in bad taste. But eventually he kind of draws the attention of the Ultimates, so Nick Fury and Iron Man and Spider-Woman is the one who... Ultimate Spider-Woman is the one who bring him in, and they kind of... He proves himself in front of them, and they give him his new suit and say, yeah, okay, look, you've got our blessing. Go out there and be the new Spider-Man. And that's the first arc is all kind of, there's lots of place setting, there's lots of character stuff. And like I said, the Miles Morales character just rings true. Like his, where he is emotionally seems to track so perfectly as you go through this arc. And it's so easy to hook into this character and root for him. But he has to learn the power responsibility dynamic as well. And he also has to learn it through his uncle, but in a very different way. And I love how the second arc does this. So Prowler is his uncle, but his dad and his dad's brother, his uncle, used to both be petty thieves. His dad turned his life around, married his mum, had Miles, became a police officer. And is kind of like on the straight and narrow, whereas his uncle went down further down the thief path and became a full-on supervillain. And his uncle Aaron figures out that he was that his nephew is Spider-Man, he tries to use him as almost his enforcer, and kind of like he does it under the guise of, hey Miles, there's this bad guy in town who I happen to be kind of warring with, will you come and help me defeat him? Like, it's going to be for the good of the city. But is increasingly leaning on him, and Miles kind of has to make a choice. He has to figure out what kind of hero he is and where the lines are. And so for him, it's his uncle trying to push him down the wrong path that teaches him the kind of the power responsibility dynamic. And it's a very nice twist. It's also like you see the agonizing from Miles in a way that's reminiscent of the Peter Parker agonizing early on, especially after his Uncle Ben is murdered. And during the fight with Miles, his Uncle Aaron is killed. It's his Uncle Aaron's fault because he's using some technology that's faulty, and he is actively trying to kill Miles, but his uncle dies during the battle, and that's kind of the end of the second volume. I think I'm just going to read on and catch up and then like read through all of the Miles Morales stuff from back in the Ultimate Universe, and because I've been reading a lot of the stuff since, and I'm surprised it's taken me this long to get around to doing it, because I really love this character. I would say kind of like current modern day Marvel, the characters that I'm most likely to want to read outside of some of the like the humor comics, the Squirrel Girls and Howard the Ducks and stuff like that, are Miss Marvel and Miles Morales Spider-Man, who just feel like these fresh, exciting characters with believable, real emotional lives, have the problems that normal teenage kids would have, but also have these superhero dilemmas as well. And they, at the moment, are much more interesting to me than the likes of Thor and Captain America and Iron Man and the kind of the characters that I really do glom onto when I'm watching the movies. I love Miles Morales, and everyone should read his comics because he's great. And boy, it got me excited about the idea of this animated Spider-Man film that's coming out next year. That's going to be great. And yeah, fingers crossed that the MCU has plans for Miles Morales in the future. And I mean, you wouldn't want to kill off Peter Parker. You wouldn't want to kill off Tom Holland's Peter Parker, I wouldn't think. It seems very dark for the MCU. Like, if you're going to kill off some characters, maybe make it the older ones. But yeah, I love the idea of Miles Morales. I can't see Donald Glover playing the kind of real evil bastard version of the Prowler that you see in this comic, but maybe he could play a more traditional Uncle Ben role for Miles Morales if and when they get around to introducing him. But yeah, so I would say, like, in terms of the comics recommendations from this week, basically the Miles Morales comics are things that, you know, it's a home run. You recommend a Miles Morales comic to me, I'm probably going to love it. The post-Secret Wars stuff, there's so little plot in there. It feels like the comic is going absolutely nowhere, or it did for a long while, and was getting waylaid by crossovers here and there. It was really grim during the Civil War II stuff, where Miles was playing an important part, but I really didn't care about Civil War II. But I still kind of like reading them. They're just a joy, and whenever Sarah Pacelli's drawing the character, then I'm in, basically. So yeah, that's in sharp contrast to the kind of the 2000 AD stuff, which probably isn't really for me. But again, it was the art there that did kind of hook me in more. So hey, maybe I'm finally coming round and I'm able to talk about appreciating the artwork of comics more than the plotting and the stories, which is a rarity for me. But those were the recommendations from this week, and that's it for this week's show. So don't forget that the next episode of the show will be a San Diego Comic-Con bonus episode. I believe just me and James talking through that stuff, but there's loads to talk about. We'll talk about stuff like the Ben Affleck Batman stuff and the Doctor Doom movie in more detail, and hopefully some of the more exciting stuff that comes out throughout the course of the weekend. But we'll definitely dive into all of that stuff a lot more than I'm able to do on the, even on a Megasode, we'll be able to dive into that a lot deeper. And then after that, our next main episode is The Amazing Spider-Man 2. Now, if you're a Patreon subscriber, James has uploaded a special commentary track for that movie where, as he promised on the podcast, he rings a bell every time something terrible happens in that film. Which I believe Seb has watched the movie with that commentary on. I think I'm going to decide what's terrible for myself, but if memory serves, a lot of it is terrible. So if you're a Patreon subscriber, you can download that and listen to that as you watch the movie. Sounds like a lot of fun. So San Diego Comic-Con special, and then The Amazing Spider-Man 2. But if you're enjoying the show, then please do subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Player FM, or your podcast app of choice, and you can find us on Patreon at patreon.com/cinematicuniverse if you want to support us, and then obviously you'll get access to that James commentary. You can find more episodes of the show and a bunch of other stuff at cinematicmultiverse.com. I'm currently working on a series of features about the MCU timeline and trying to make sense of it based on the information that they give us in the movies. That has proved to be a headache. You can get in touch via Facebook, on Twitter at @cine_verse, and you can send us an email to editorial@cinematicuniverse.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in just a couple of days.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.